are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, April 26, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Daniel Marins, political reporter for Huffington Post. We're talking about Kristen Gillibrand's new proposal for postal banking, a public banking option. New results in Arizona's 8th district. Republicans hold on to a seat, but another very significantly decreased margin. And are the Democrats headed to a genuinely progressive position and to victory or not? All that and more with Daniel Marins. Plus, Ronny Jackson withdraws from withdraws as Trump's nominee to lead Veteran Affairs, and the CIA refuses to declassify more information about Gina Haspel. What a surprise.
It's probably really exculpatory.
Yeah, I'm sure it's super exculpatory. Maybe like she felt bad before she personally tortured people at black sites in Thailand. Scott Pruitt plans to defend himself on Capitol Hill by spreading the blame. And which, you know,
it's a good strategy.
Yeah, I was gonna say it seems pretty legit in the context of all of these people. And HUD Secretary Ben Carson, and I can't even do the impression for this because it's just so disgusting, is proposing to raise the rent of low-income Americans who receive federal housing subsidies. Because, of course, all that and much, much more on today's show. Yesterday, there was a good news and a bad news for Donald Trump. The good news, thank you, Kanye. Very cool. Bad news is that this tall monster, mega cuck hater, James Comey, is still on his messy chick from Jersey media tour, and Trump is super upset about it. And, you know, like the rest of us, and this is, there's nothing Donald Trump can do that's humanizing, because he's subhuman, in my estimation. But I will say this. All of us, every single one of us, in times of great trial and tribulation, maybe a personal crisis, maybe the former director of the FBI has said that you conduct yourself like a mob boss and isn't entirely convinced that you don't want to get peed on by Russian prostitutes, you know, stuff that we all go through. What you do is you go to your friends and you vent and you bond. And that's why, and we have more clips of this, we're going to give you a little teaser of the first one here. Donald Trump went on Fox and Friends to be with his friends, to talk about people who are not their friends.
Gave it to a friend to leak classified information. It's all classified. It was totally classified. So he did an illegal act, and he said it himself, in order to get a special counsel against me. So the special counsel, and by the way, and Intelligence Committee and everybody else has found no collusion. There's no collusion with me in the Russia. Nobody's been tougher to Russia than I am. You can ask President Putin about that. There's been nobody between the military and the oil and all of the other things that I've done. The aluminum tax, they send us a lot of aluminum, and I put tariffs on aluminum coming in. The 60 people that we sent out, the 60 so-called diplomats, nobody's been tougher. Nobody's even been close to us. Tough as me, and we hear this nonsense going. So there's no collusion whatsoever. Well, Comey, what he did, Brian, was terrible. He leaked classified information in order to try and get a special counsel.
He says it wasn't classified, Mr. President. He says it wasn't classified.
Oh, it's totally classified.
This is another irresistible. Like, could you imagine that same scenario? Like Obama on Amy Goodman, just like, yeah, and they did it. It was totally classified. And it was a lie. It was a pathetic. Mr. President, they say it wasn't classified. Yeah, it was totally classified. It was like super classified, double X classified.
Whenever there are interviews like this where Trump's on his home turf, I think about like all those write-ups where they're like, he's a genius of language. He knows how to break down the media better than anyone ever. It's like...
It's instinctual.
Yeah, it's just instinctual. This is remarkable.
I'm tapped into Jungian archetypes. Oh my God.
The whole thing is really worth watching for anyone following along at home.
Well, we definitely are going to get to more of it.
Yeah, we got about three more minutes of it, but yeah, it is 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
Don't you worry.
It's like a FDR fireside chat.
Right. And by the way, it was totally... It was a total failure.
There are tapes of FDR talking about like a political opponent's having affairs, actually. White House tapes.
I wish that our Democratic presidents were more like that, frankly. I demand that when Bernie's president, he come on my show, a Majority Report, and be like, oh, yeah, because they're losers. Because it was totally classified. And by the way, it was also stupid. And no one's been better on it than me. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Daniel Marins. This is the Majority Report. There's going to be good times. I think some people in the chat maybe noticed something in a certain sense. Joining us now is Daniel Marins. He is a reporter based in Washington, D.C. for the Huffington Post. Dan, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here, Mike.
It's a pleasure talking with you. It's been too long, man. There's a couple of things that I want to get to, and we'll start, I guess... On a policy level, we can assess her motives and you know, sincerity and how this fits into the sort of broader context of the sort of internal Democratic struggle right now. But you have a new piece on Christian Gillibrand proposing a postal banking option. And it's one of these things that, I mean, probably people in this audience already have a sense of and how positive and beneficial it could be. It sounds a little wonky, but there's major implications for lower-income people accessing financial services and also protecting people across the board from predatory lenders.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. First of all, Mike, I really gotta correct you on something. It's Kirsten, Kristen.
Excuse me.
This is a mistake that Jesus and Mero made when she was on their show.
Exactly.
I want to give her that respect. Yeah,
pardon me.
I mean, there's a lot of commonalities there.
Exactly.
But yeah, like this has been something, look, certainly as many people in my mentions have told me, and I certainly knew this, that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were a little bit more, had or have already spoken sort of vocally in favor of this. There's a guy named Dave Dayan, who I'm sure your listeners know, who's been beating this drum for a hell of a long time.
Yep.
And the Postal Service itself, I mean, the Inspector General of the Postal Service was like, hey, we need money. This looks like a pretty good deal. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a secondary motive there. But basically, for those who aren't familiar, maybe need some refreshing, in the United States, until from 1911 to 1967, there was postal banking. You could basically open up an account, put your money there, they would give you some low interest rate, and then you'd be able to put it in and withdraw it. There was no lending, so it wasn't a full kind of basic banking service, if you will. But this has precedent in the United States. And around the world, in the vast majority of developed nations, there is a more sophisticated form of this, whether it's to the point where, you know, you go to France, if you see a post office, there's like an ATM thing on the side there. And, you know, I remember that from studying abroad there. They may not all have lending services, but that is the key the super progressive piece of this, because if you've got a bank account for a low-income person or someone in a rural area without a bank branch or someone in a deeply under-resourced, disinvested part of an American city that are overwhelmingly black and brown, and frankly, if you don't have enough money, there's all kinds of fees and balance issues. So just having a bank account, if you're quote-unquote unbanked, then it is really key, because these check cashing joints and these prepaid debit cards like are basically just gouging poor people.
Right.
But, where the lending piece comes in, and I think this is like really exciting for people, because the kind of the top of the pyramid of the low-income financier vampires are these payday lenders that basically just trap people in debt through these kind of triple-digit annual interest rates, where people end up paying way more than the actual principal of a loan in interest and fees. And we're talking about people, often, typically making in, the 10 teens, 20s, thousands of dollars a year. So If you then have a government agency that does not have a profit motive, that is still going to basically charge some interest to make it worth their while and maybe to guard against some risk, offering that service and doing it in through this infrastructure that's just already out there existing and maybe is being slightly less used, because snail mail, has taken a little bit of a downturn, not as much as people think.
Right.
Then it's a really nice little policy marriage, and it's got all this precedent and existing infrastructure. So it's maybe like the least pie in the sky progressive dream policy that there is.
And has HERD legislation, we'll get to the politics of it in a minute, but is there buy-in from the David Danes of the world? I mean, my sense from your piece is that this isn't this is a solid piece of legislation. What they wrote, what the people wrote on her staff and what she's putting forward, it's good. It isn't a sort of piecemeal version of what we're talking about.
Yeah, right. Like it's not a pilot program. It's
right.
Not let's do savings and deposits, but not lending. So she was just like, no. Like I need to be able to say that I'm shiving payday lenders. And you read it and what she says to me, she's just like, fuck these people.
Right.
One
of the fun things about her is she actually literally does say stuff like that.
Her rhetoric has totally changed. I'm like just getting chats from my editor. Yeah, but like they worked with someone called Mersa Baradaran, who is a
yep.
University of Georgia law professor.
Yeah, we had her on the show.
And And so you're asking, do they have buy-in from the progressive, kind of literati, cognoscenti? I mean, she's, the person.
Right.
She's a national authority. So I think that, the answer is yes.
Right. So basically we have a situation now where, Gillibrand, Booker, there is this sort of lane in the Senate, Kamala Harris, where they're definitely reading the tea leaves and sort of moving left. And I guess, The two parts of it that are interesting to me, and one is just purely, seems like purely operational. It seems like the kind of argument about whether or not to, you know, finding that balance basically between, you know, the Democratic establishment has kind of pushes a narrative of like, you know, don't pressure these people no matter what. We got to resist Trump. I mean, we see these talking points with regards to Cynthia Nixon and Andrew Cuomo. And then on the other hand, there's, you know, another sort of contingent that, you know, at times kind of won't take yes for an answer. But it seems like the basic context that now we have some other potential candidates who are more obscure, like I think the governor of Montana is an example, who are sort of putting forward the more like, you know, retro 1990s vintage sort of message. But these very centrist figures in the Senate are moving politically. And I guess my question is that a fair read? And then do you think, you know, moving forward, how durable is that? Like with these, you know, because certainly at least in, you know, Gillibrand and Booker's case, I mean, these are people that have been, I mean, you know, she represented a district in upstate New York. So she had a very different record on, you know, guns and immigration, as an example. Representing New York, there's obviously very close ties to Wall Street and the banking industry. And Cory Booker's whole career has been underwritten by finance. So, you know, maybe get to the sort of the dynamics of the pivot, if I'm even reading that correctly. And then more broadly, durable you think it is. Yeah.
Yeah, these are great questions, and I think these are things that sort of the rank and file progressive activists are asking themselves every day. And look, I think that there is there's one piece of this, right? As you said, have you made yourself politically relevant enough? Have you shown that these are winning issues enough, that there's a hunger for these ambitious policies that sort of previously moderate Democrats are now saying, oh, no, yeah, that's me. And then have you shown yourself to be strong enough and politically relevant enough that they then feel obligated to sort of stick with that and deliver on it? I will say that each of these cases needs to be taken on its own. But in terms of broadly speaking, you know, these kind of Senate Dems, I wouldn't even call them like the most centrist, but we're basically talking about this crew of people who are not Elizabeth Warren and Bernie, who are like shortlisted for presidential 2020 nominations and have been talking to donors and sort of laying the groundwork. You know, there's a couple different things here. So if someone like Cory Booker says he's not taking pharma donations and he's from New Jersey, which is a pharma hub,
right?
And he does it, you know, at the time, really, and I think sincerely for political reasons, he was genuinely just tired of getting guff for it. You know, he maintained that he could maintain his independence about it, but he doesn't actually say, like, you know, I've changed my mind and taking money from pharma is bad. He said that, you know, it was a distraction, and I've actually heard him say that personally. But the thing that the dynamic that changes here is that you have a guy like Connor Lamb, who again is also an interesting test case in that special election in Pennsylvania. He raised $4 million just online.
Yep.
So there is an infrastructure component of this where the risk is lower on the push side. So I don't think that if you're Cory Booker and you've dug in on this, that there's a universe where you're so desperate for that cash that it makes sense to flop back. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just don't even need the cash as much anymore because you can shake the activist money tree. And the activists aren't going to give you that money unless you do things like saying, I'm not taking pharma money.
Right, no doubt. So do you think then in the context of your talking with activists, and we'll get to the Arizona special election in a minute, but that's very interesting to me because it strikes me that if activists are exerting some of that power, and let's not overread it, but at the same time, someone like Cory Booker representing New Jersey with his political record, the simple reality of him not taking pharma money is actually a small sea change in American politics. There's no doubt about it. On the activist side, what I'm wondering is, do you think that there's a perception from that sort of success and pressure that not only do they need to keep it up, even if, say, you know, Bernie's elected and you have an actual for real progressive president, that because the forces basically of corporate oligarchy are, you know, structurally aligned to benefit in this country against broader public interests, that, you know, action and pressure is going to need to be continuous. And does that also, you think, some of that same, you know, energy that gets applied electorally, do you think that some of these activists are also thinking about more broadly, like, what are all of the things that we need to bring to bear on this? You know, protest, exposure, local action. You know, I guess what I'm saying is there a sort of, in this resurgence of action and some of the results that it's getting, is it, do you think on the activist side, it's also getting framed to include but extend beyond even like the game of Democratic Party politics?
Oh, interesting. And yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I can tell you that, like, some of the, that certainly the labor fight in Arizona, for example, so that it cut the other way.
Yep.
Where activism on a non-electoral issue had electoral spillover effects, yeah, for Democrats there, and probably will continue to do so if they can keep this heat going. And, you know, there have been a number of Oklahoma state legislature seats that have flipped even before the Oklahoma teacher strike, where that was a factor, very clearly. Do I think that if a factory shuts down and they're thinking about it and it's in bankruptcy deliberations and you've got a hot Democratic primary in that district, that someone's going to see that and that's going to then, or that activists are going to mobilize on behalf of a particular candidate, and then that's going to be an existing core for labor to take advantage of or something like that? I assume we're talking about labor, we're talking about criminal justice, grassroots,
yeah,
activists and everything like that.
Yeah, exactly, right.
You know, I don't know that I've seen it yet go the other way, in the sense of having moving the needle electorally, reaping benefits for people in kind of like public policy fights, social movement type fights. Mm-hmm. Maybe actually, you know what, maybe the best example of that is in the case of Dominion Energy in Virginia, which I spoke about on this show, where you had this blue wave at the state legislative level, and it's all these little tiny groups, you know, Network Nova, Network Northern Virginia, which is like, we can basically think of all these groups as indivisible groups. They're reading the Indivisible Guide and, you know, the hashtag resistance. And they include like sort of dyed in the wool lefties and kind of more run of the mill Democrats. And even some people that are maybe just pissed off at Trump.
Yeah.
is that they were able to really reform, like sort of tighten up and buck the Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, not necessarily buck him, but force him into a position where he was signing an energy regulation bill that was a lot tougher and blocked this issue of double dipping by the utility companies, precisely because they had this existing network from the mobilization in November for the election.
Right. I think that's exactly what I would be. And I also just want to add to the mix, too. I think the other, like, I think what Larry Krasner is doing as DA in Philadelphia is also really sort of putting even more pressure if you're running some type of particularly left campaign where you're going into some type of, executive position, basically. I mean, he's setting a roadmap of like, yeah, I'm delivering. Right. Like, I didn't, you know, campaign on all this stuff and now I'm in office and I've got to placate all these other interests. Like, I'm just doing it. And I actually think in a certain way, it was national news again yesterday because of Meek Mill. But I think he is also a kind of subtle sort of prompt and raising expectation levels across the board, too. But let's get to Arizona. I believe it was Arizona's 8th district. Republican, yeah, there was just reelected, but a radically decreased margin. Talk about that. Who are the players?
Yeah, so, okay. It wasn't a reelected Republican, but Republicans held the seat. It was an open seat because Trent Franks, one of the sort of staunchest abortion opponents in the United States House, an incredibly wealthy former oil executive, actually. And these are in kind of like the, I guess you could say, like, it's an area of Phoenix suburbs. It doesn't include any of the city of Phoenix, but it's Phoenix suburbs that include places like Sun City, which is basically like a planned golf course community for people 55 and older. So we're talking about generally middle class to wealthy retirees.
That type of place that like Jamie on our show is planning on retiring to. A Arizona built, yeah, man built golf course.
Yeah, sounds like
community.
Me.
Yeah.
Very eco.
Yeah, very eco.
Because Arizona has a ton of water, right. And it's yeah. great to play golf there.
Right.
Yeah, so super it's actually called Sun City, which has South Africa parallels. I know you'd appreciate
exactly. I did notice that. That's kind of terrifying. Yeah. What do we call this place that we want to exclude minorities from and have a man-built white golf course closed city on? What was a place that people wouldn't perform at in the 80s? Oh, got it, right.
And there's another town called Sun City West. So, you know, that this is kind of the character. This is not Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania's 18th, where, like, you know, like, the kind of grandpa figure of organized labor, just you can still occasionally get him up off the couch, you know, like,
right.
Metaphorically speaking, like labor wasn't really a factor. It was also not a very diverse district, but you've got old folks and you've also just got like some ordinary people, some of whom probably don't always vote in elections like this. And Trent Franks had to resign in December in disgrace, really at the urging of Paul Ryan, because he apparently pretty creepily approached at least one of his female staff members about being a surrogate mother for him and his wife.
Oh, he was the surrogate mother guy. Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah. And you know, he's like this extraordinarily wealthy oil multimillionaire. So he's just like, yeah, I'll give you $5 million. And maybe the creepiest part of it is that, you know, and that there was apparently more than one conversation about this. But apparently, like, one of the creepier parts was it wasn't exactly clear whether he wanted it to be, like, a sperm donor type situation or just, like, a, you know, handmaiden sort of thing, you know,
right.
like a
right.
handmaid's tale.
Yep.
where, like, you know, the Bible says you can be my concubine, you know, right. just to carry my child.
It's in the Bible.
And so, you know, whatever, that has all the different implications. He's like the 40th House Republican to either announce they were retiring or resign suddenly this year. Right. And basically, the Democrats had their own little primary. Actually, and this is something I didn't really write about at all, but there's a transgender woman, Breonna Westbrook, who's also a car salesperson, who apparently some activists credit her for pushing Hero Tipperninny, the physician and healthcare advocate, ever so slightly to the left, though, you know, I've heard that disputed. And so you have this candidate, someone who immigrated with her family from India at the age of 3, grew up in Ohio, has been living in this district though for 21 years, public school parent, and was an emergency room doctor until about 10 years ago. And as Republicans point out, she was sued for malpractice. That's like pretty common, I think.
Yeah, that's I'm a fan of the trial lawyers in a lot of ways, but I mean, if you're a doctor getting sued for malpractice is not, yeah, that's actually fairly typical. Doesn't mean maybe she did do something wrong, but that doesn't stand
right,
out.
Right. Like, right.
And it's pretty ironic like that Republicans like who doing everything to make sure that people, you know, doctors, insurance companies, and hospitals can do whatever they want. It's a pretty rich line of attack for them, but whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Totally. And, you know, so they had this whole thing like, oh, she's appearing in scrubs in her ad. It's like, gotta dust those off, but whatever. And then they had this, since then she had been working for a nonprofit sort of advocating cancer research in her, still using, you know, her doctor capacities. And she was running against a conservative former state senator, kind of like a very, very typical post 2010 sort of, you know, and I think that I'll look to see exactly when she came in to office, but you know, this was someone who, to me, represented. Yeah, so she had been a member really since 2009, so not exactly the Tea Party wave, but extremely conservative, tied to conservative billionaire money for sure. Was the lead sponsor of a private school voucher bill in the Arizona State Senate. You know, sort of the whole nine yards, anti-abortion, very much embodies the Obama era red state, just gut state government public spending attitude, and just to cut taxes and to privatize things.
Right.
And so it was a matchup between Hiro Tippernini and Debbie Lesko, and this conservative person. And I think what was so interesting to me, and I didn't, you know, I mean, it wasn't necessarily the headline of my coverage, but when you're looking at, as I really do in everything that I look at, the sort of Overton window, the acceptable policy discourse window moving in the United States, here you had someone, Dr. Hiro Tippernini, someone who was a physician running in a district that Trent Franks had won by like 35% the last time he ran. It was almost, I think the nominee against him in 2016 was a Green Party member. I mean, the Dems hadn't even nominated anybody.
Oh,
that's
wow.
How ridiculous this district was.
Right.
And Trump won it by 21 points. So there were some, you know, you often see this phenomenon of like, clearly there were Republicans who couldn't stomach Trump in that district. But still, you're talking about a very, very conservative district. You're not even really talking about a working class one in like the Rust Belt or something like that, where you can kind of do a jujitsu sort of move.
Right.
This was, and she basically said, look, I'm a doctor. I've seen how medical healthcare is practiced in this country. And I just don't think that the private insurance companies are going to get their act together unless we create real competition, and real competition would include a public option for all, a Medicare buy-in option.
Right.
And to me, that was remarkable because she identified as a moderate Democrat. She told me this. She's like, oh, I'm a moderate Democrat. I'm data-driven. I'm a scientist. But it in terms of her actual policies, she was for Medicare buy-in, and she only lost by something like between 5 and 6 points in a district that Trump won by 20 points. So I think that's incredibly significant. And she also leaned heavily into defending Social Security and Medicare,
yep,
which is interesting, you know, and maybe politically expedient in a senior-heavy district. But as you know, 5 or 6 years ago, that's not even happening in a district like that. That's not something that Democrats were embracing.
Not at all. So, I mean, so the kind of three big lessons that I'm hearing are like, first, yes, this isn't the type of district where, you know, you can sort of make the look, just run a Bernie style campaign. Or even in Conor Lamb's case, yes, he was right on guns, on abortion, which are, you know, and even on abortion, he wasn't actually running you know, he was actually just culturally signifying that he's personally opposed, but not actually in any way committed to changing the legal
right.
status of abortion.
Right.
But, and I remember I was on a panel on some a TV show after this, and the Republican guy was, you know, all over the place with, well, this was, you know, an anomaly, and Conor Lamb was, you know, he was anti-Pelosi and anti-guns and pro-guns and blah, blah. And I was like, you know, I basically said, I was like, dude, he was talking about labor unions raising wages and social, like that was his campaign. It was actually all economic populism, and that made a big difference. But this wasn't that kind of district at all. There wasn't you called it the jiu-jitsu, this sort of move of the judo move. And then, but then at the same time, like, what is defined as moderate is getting really radically expanded. And I think, you know, the irony of it is if you go back to Obamacare, even people like Jacob Hacker at Yale, right, they really were saying that basically, like, yes, the public option is a thing that good, you know, at least like actual liberals want because they care about public delivery and they understand that the healthcare industry is dangerous and pernicious. But the way this thing is designed and the complexity of it, a major part of it, it stands on having a public option. So it is interesting that she's just sort of going back in some ways to just that, like a genuinely data-driven position. Not one that sort of talks data, but actually just sort of is political amelioration. Like that's actual data. If you want to pursue that kind of approach to healthcare, of sort of a managed care, regulated, competitive market, it's not going to succeed without a public option.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's pretty interesting, and you can then say if you make it like sort of like a this is just an option, you don't need to talk about the price tag either.
Right.
You know, it was sort of interesting to hear because it's then just like oh well, people will just pay premiums like into right. it. You know, she wasn't talking about it like being the same exact Medicare program for those people. But you know, the Republicans were kind of interesting on this because they saw this as like a huge soft underbelly. I mean, they leaned hard into like, I mean, her opponent was like, you know, basically you're Bernie Sanders, you know, I mean, she literally said that in a televised debate, mm-hmm. you know, and all the experts say Bernie Sanders Medicare for All plan is going to cost $32 trillion. And the NRCC, which elects Republicans to the House, was telling me like, you know, yep, we're stomping out single payer. This is just another. She'll be the first single payer advocate to lose, but certainly not the last.
Did they say it like that too? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like you know Bradley Whitford and Billy Madison, but or Jay Moore. I forget who the actor was, but
Jay
it was
Moore.
Like, yeah, right. Yeah. But like it was like you know it was. It was literally a quote like that. I don't have it in front of me, but it was like, you know, she'll be one of many, you know, single payer advocates. And it's just like, okay, so they're reduced to talking to everything like single payer. And I didn't even heard like Conor Lamb, who wasn't even talking about a Medicare buy-in. They, like in his, in like, I heard like the state Republican Party chair at some event there being like, it's socialism, single payer, and sanctuary cities. It's like, not like, you know, it doesn't resonate when it's clearly not true, but B, maybe it just doesn't resonate. And, you know, I think a really interesting test case of this, Michael, will be races like Randy Bryce's, because Randy Bryce is interesting in that he's running in a difficult district. I think, prior to Ryan's resignation, it was even higher, like more difficult. I'm sure that he and his campaign wouldn't even like me saying this, but I think in some ways, a lot of the establishment support that he got was about giving the middle finger to Paul Ryan,
right.
And that you know, he's getting support from everyone, right? He's got NARAL, he's got now the DCCC and Citizens United. These are groups that are more associated with the establishment arm. And of course, he was recruited by the Working Families Party, and he's endorsed by Our Revolution, and on. And I think the people that are really excited and driving his candidacy are still progressive activists. But I almost feel like national DC-based Democrats were kind of like, well, he's almost sort of like, yeah, we got this really authentic blue-collar guy that we can pit against Paul Ryan. Isn't that a nice little narrative turn for us?
Right.
Whereas now it's like you don't have the Speaker of the House in there with $11 million in cash on hand who can just raise millions, you know, with the snap of a finger. This is looking like a real race, and you have the situation where the D-Trip basically I think was forced to deal seriously with them because of how much money he raised. That one of their red to blue candidates is just not only an out-and-out Medicare for All advocate, but an abolish ICE guy.
Yep.
So that's, I think, and I'm keeping my eye on a bunch of those. One dynamic that's interesting and that I'm thinking about writing about is that because you talk about this kind of cohort of Senate Democrats that is really, and by the way, you know, just talking about Kirsten Gillibrand, if she is, you know, sort of just putting it on or really kind of if it in any way is look, we know that it's politically expedient, but if it in any way doesn't reflect her values, that she hasn't actually moved in terms of her core convictions. I will say, from having spoken to her, she's damn good at sounding like it.
Right.
And
right.
That was not something that you could say of Hillary Clinton, for example. You know, Hillary would sure. check the box.
Right.
She'd be like, oh, now I'm against TPP. You know, and it would be in like some press release and, you know, or, but like Gillibrand is like, no, like not everything should be for profit. What has this country become? So, I mean, she was saying things like that to me. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. But what's interesting to me, and it may be a function to some extent of gerrymandering, the function to some extent of the election year thing, is that these big, ambitious, progressive ideas are coming out of the Senate and not the House.
Yeah.
And it's the House campaign arm, the D-Trip, that is doing all this sort of like heavy-handed intervention in primaries with a, what I would, you know, I think is a very narrow idea of what an electable candidate is in general election. To be fair, as I know, this is an election year for the entire House, right? This is not every 6 years. I mean, a lot of these people have a little bit more leeway,
right?
And they're dealing with Republican gerrymandered districts. But it just seems like when you've got Hiro Tipperney, who for all of the challenges that she faced in that district, and frankly, you know, for better or for worse, the attacks that they were able to land against her, you know, from her personal and professional history. Again, you know, I don't put any stock in them, but those were things that maybe someone like Connor Lamb didn't have right. working against them.
Right.
You have her coming within 5 points on a Medicare buy-in, and House Democrats are like, nah, we got to run, you know, like a veteran who hates deficits.
Right. And I mean, it's just amazing. Like they're sort of like, I don't even know what the appropriate, they're sort of like, they're almost like, can we get like Coolio on this song? He's hot in the streets right now. I mean, they're just in a stuck in this incredible time warp. Yeah, it's very, very 90s. I guess last, I just want to touch briefly on, because speaking of 90s, Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
You know, Cynthia Nixon, I mean, she's come out of the gate much stronger than I expected. I do think with Gillibrand, I want to bring her in this. Like, look, I'm not, I think to some extent, I mean, unless it's somebody like Andrew Cuomo, who is just really, in my view, just fundamentally untrustable. So even if he is moving left, I want him gone and I want him to lose, because I just think he fundamentally is both not trustworthy and actually is, to the extent he's committed to anything, he is committed to a, you know, very right-wing, very finance, real estate, and charter school-oriented, with some nods to social liberalism. Like, that's what his politics are. Maybe somebody like Gillibrand,
right.
You know, she's reading the same things that everybody else is reading, and just, like, some aspects of the sort of, you know, liberal elite, for lack of a better phrase, they're following the trends, and they're moving a bit more left, and they are reading, you know, smart professors who are advocating, you know, postal banking. I mean, you know, these people are not immutable and uninfluenceable. But at the same time, you know, to me, there is a rubber meets the road thing in that she did endorse Cuomo, and that does kind of reinforce, yeah. you know, her allegiance, I think, to, you know, a really broken system. But I just want to know, you know, what do you, I mean, at the very least, is Cynthia Nixon any hopes? Because I think he was gearing up. He did have 2020 ambitions, as delusional as they may be. Is she at the very least totally kneecapping them? Could she actually win? And what is de Blasio's role in all of this? Those are like the three things I'd like you to ring on before we close.
Well, I'll start with the last.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's pretty obvious when the two political consultants who engineered de Blasio's successful 2013 mayoral run, Bill Hires and Rebecca Katz, are at the helm of Cynthia Nixon's campaign, that this is at the very least going on with de Blasio's blessing, right? Okay. I mean, if de Blasio, like, you know, I'm not like super well sourced in that world to the degree that I can say, like, I'm hearing that he gave her the nod. We do have de Blasio telling Naomi Kahn's a couple of months before Cynthia Nixon's announcement that he wanted a vibrant primary for Cuomo. That's not something that you ordinarily hear Democrats saying about an incumbent Democratic governor. I think it I think that her run is modeled on de Blasio. I think it's modeled on the understanding that Andrew Cuomo's hold on Metro New York, which really sank Seth Leach out, is not unshakable. And I think one of the really remarkable things, and to get to the second question, whether she's electable as governor, I think one of the really remarkable things about Cynthia Nixon is that, you know, people sometimes sort of, they look at a figure like Bernie and they're like, you know, I know his heart is in the right place on racial justice. I wish he would just say it a little more. And Cynthia Nixon says it all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, she really, every speech she gives hits corporate Democrats, hits establishment Democrats, talks about taking on finance and real estate in New York, talks about universal benefits, ambitious progressive legislation, and then talks about how that intersects with housing segregation for black families in New York City who are getting pushed out of their neighborhoods.
Right.
And talks about how they intersect with the school to prison pipeline.
Right.
And so that is such a prominent part of her stump speech that they can't ever really use that against her. And that, I think,
the way
been,
she talked about, you know, how we need to legalize marijuana. I mean, across the board, that's the right policy, but she connected it specifically to the already, you know, the de facto realities in a place like New York, that things like arrests for marijuana were, you know, you could go to a time when it was not decriminalized and it was illegal, and you could walk around certain neighborhoods and smell it everywhere, and it was just not going to be enforced. And in other neighborhoods, you know, neighborhoods of color and working class neighborhoods, that was the opening door of stop and frisk and all the rest. So, I mean, she zeroed right in on both the policy that's universally right and the racial disparities of it. And she has been doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, no, and she sort of like has this line about John Boehner getting rich off of that, and how you need to make sure that not just that you legalize it, but that you sort of include the communities that have been disproportionately punished by the criminalization policy make sure they share in these new opportunities and in that wealth. Look, she's got an uphill battle. There is enormous power in incumbency. It's a powerful governorship in New York. I think that this is not the same, you know, if I were reading tea leaves, and first of all, she shaved 16 points off of Cuomo's lead in the poll within 3 weeks. I mean, from the start of her campaign to right around when she got the Working Families Party endorsement, that's pretty significant. That means that she's getting out there, that there's a little bit more name recognition there. Mm-hmm. This is not this is a post Bernie Sanders New York primary electors. Yep. So it's not the same thing as in 2014. And you have a governor running for a third term. So a third term, like most states don't even allow that, or maybe not most, but a ton of them.
Significant amount. Yeah.
And you also have the fact that he's now in this dance where whatever progressive not pivot he makes, because he is just an incredibly calculating person, and that should be used to everybody's advantage, and that can have good dividends, right?
Right.
But the story is always, oh, he just gave parolees, you know, however many tens of thousands of parolees the right to vote. Cynthia Nixon's doing a good job. And so that's kind of an awkward dance that I don't know that he had to do when he was up against Zephyr. Because a lot of the stuff that with Zephyr, it was sort of future promises, and then people got burned, and so it's really, really, really interesting to watch. Cuomo was already not very well liked upstate, just I think probably for cultural reasons, that he sounds like a New York City guy. He's got that Queens accent, and he's also pretty heavy-handed on the cultural issues. Which Cynthia will be too, but maybe in a less, I don't know, you know, maybe she'll pick them up on other issues like, you know, clean water and
well, yeah, I
rights.
Think that's the bet, right? Like, hey, guys, like, look, we're going to move forward on, you know, LGBTQ community. We're going to be clear on, you know, reproductive justice. But like, you're not just a backwater to economically exploit and environmentally pollute. I mean, that's basically Andrew's message to upstate, is like, The only people I care about are financiers and, you know, a handful of modest moves on social issues. And besides that, you can go screw yourself. So I think, yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me that that would be like kind of the fair, you know, trade off. And I don't know if New York, there's a difference between people being a bit more, you know, moderate or conservative or slow moving versus like reactionary. And I don't think anybody right. who's in a Democratic primary is going to be, you know, reactionary on those issues. That's my read.
Oh, yeah, definitely not in the primary. Not in the primary. And I think the New York GOP is just in such shambles at this point that talking about the general seriously, it's pretty hard to imagine, especially in a midterm year like this with the national environment. Look, and I'll leave it on this. I'm looking very closely at the race because I think it would be – there aren't a ton of great progressive proofs of concept yet on – you know, in a challenging primary or in a swing district or something like that, where the left candidate won the primary and then won the general. And then people can then point to that and say, look, this approach, it doesn't just work with Pramila Jayapal in Seattle. It works in the Phoenix suburbs. It works in the entire state of New York with all of the financial interests, with all the rural voters. And so that's what people need to be looking for. And I think to your point, to what you were starting to say, Michael, the potential trap that progressive activists could fall in the carrot and stick dance that they're trying to do is that there's just not enough carrot. Mm-hmm. And when you elect leaders and you show them that you can elect them, that's a carrot. And when you tell Cory Booker, like, I'm going to stop making snarky tweets about you because you're moving in the right direction and I will take yes for an answer, you're also showing power because you're showing that when people do the right thing, there's a reward for them. And so there is a danger in being too tough.
It's got to be balanced. Got to be tough, but you got to be nice. Daniel Marins, I beard you on that one, dude. Daniel Marins,
that's awesome.
Huffington Post political reporter. Look forward to talking with you again soon. Next time on TMBS, man.
All right.
Thanks
Talk
a lot.
Talk soon, Mike.
Take care. Bye. All right, everybody. No, on principle, I'm not going to do that. Skype always asks you to review their calls after you're done with a call. And it's
do
really
some
irritating.
Free labor for us.
Yeah.
A tech company, do us some free labor by giving us your opinions.
Exactly.
Tell us what we're doing wrong for free.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't Skype free, though?
Who cares? They're making they're good. Twitter's free and free. It exists entirely because of our free labor that we give it.
You should check out the Twitter update that happened yesterday and...
Oh, yeah.
Turn that off your phone.
Brendan scared Sam about this because it asks you to just give everything away, basically. Give us all your data.
Let us backdoor into all of your data.
To help
Wait,
you
what?
Out.
Oh.
Yeah,
did you
see
the update, the mobile Twitter update?
I didn't get the mobile Twitter update yet, no.
I got it yesterday after Brendan told me about it.
I'm such a social media cuck. I just say yes to everything at this point in time. Like, there's nothing I can do. What
you
am I
going
to do?
Back.
Not tweet? Psh.
Well, I mean,
no, on this update, they still let you tweet, but they're basically like, let us backdoor our way into all of your like Twitter information.
Why would anyone say yes to that?
Well, why did you?
Because you just click yes.
I haven't yet.
It's really easy
I can't
to change,
fit
though.
Updates on my phone right now. It's on its last legs.
I the step that I made to the extent any of these things matter, and it's actually been great. I don't use Facebook that much anymore. Anyways, but deleting all Facebook apps from my phone is a massive improvement.
Yep. It's probably
life.
A good idea.
Oh, it's
definitely the
a
messaging
no-brainer.
App because that thing is insane.
No, the messaging app is poison, and it's just
what is it?
Great to not have it, anything on there. What?
What is it about the messaging app?
I forget.
I use it
maybe
for
I'll
people
look
that
it
I don't
up.
Text.
Oh, really? Yeah. There's some insane.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember the specifics of it, but it was like sort of shockingly intrusive. It was like in that particular Facebook fashion when they're like, you know, Silicon Valley is like the stalker economy, and we're like, you know, we're outside your window. Like, we're the guy in the boombox. The other companies, like, just sort of know your subway routes and are following you from a respectable distance. We're right outside of your window.
To help with connectivity.
To help with connectivity.
Well, exactly. My phone will be in airplane mode for the entirety of the 24-hour drone concert that I'm attending.
Sweet.
This weekend. Right. Emergencies only.
Guys, become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop. There's still, till the end of the month, 30% off of fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code. I don't even know if there's a coupon code. I think it's just 30% off the whole shebang. We should have it on the blog post. So go to JustCoffee.coop. Get an amazing deal on all of your favorite fair trade blends. Check out, of course, The Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS, or on iTunes or on our YouTube channel. Jamie Peck Patreon and Jamie Peck. Was there a new Antifada that dropped?
Yes,
when?
Yesterday.
Sweet.
I'm very excited about it.
And it's now that you can get that on iTunes as well.
Yes.
Perfect. All right, guys. We'll see you on the flip side.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost has what?